Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and as you can hear from the exuberant noises happening behind me, which for the first time in 3 years, we haven't had to play in from a previously made recording. We are coming to you from the Pulford Awards, Private Eye's annual award for investigative journalism. We're going to be speaking to every single nominee on the shortlist. We're going to be hearing about the brilliant journalists who are carrying on the legacy of Paul Foot. And to kick off that process, let's begin with Susie Boniface of the Daily Mirror. Here's Susie.
We've actually been campaigning on this since the early 80s, when the nuclear test veterans first started coming forward and reporting cancers and illness and birth defects in their children. Now, they've been let down by successive governments, and we asked for a medal in 2018. That went to review, got refused. So in continuation, really, of like a 40-year campaign, we had a one-year campaign. We demanded that Britain's nuclear test veterans get to see the Prime Minister in person.
So for those who don't know about the nuclear test veterans, Britain carried out nuclear tests from the early 50s onwards.
The first nuclear test was in 1952, called Operation Hurricane, in the Montebello Islands. And that was our first atomic bomb. We did another 44 weapons after that, and coupled with almost 600 so-called minor trials in the Australian outback, which were highly radioactive explosions of plutonium, uranium, and other toxic materials.
And who was there at the time? What organisations were these veterans from? Were they military? Were they civilian?
Well, this was the biggest tri-service operation since D-Day. So it was Army, Navy and Air Force. There was also Merchant Navy. There were civilians. There were AWRE scientists. And we know from government studies that were very recently reported that they've all had very, very high rates of early mortality and cancer. And they all have served their country to obtain the nuclear deterrent at a time when we felt we needed that. And perhaps we still do with Putin and Ukraine. And they've been woefully and shamefully mistreated and ignored by governments ever since 1952, when Churchill ordered that first test.
One of the aspects of the story I found, I mean, maybe I shouldn't have found it surprising, but I did. I found it surprising and horrifying, was the fact that there were two reports published, one of which was very brief and one of which wasn't. I wonder, could you tell us more about those?
So in 1983, the veterans started coming forward to their stories of ill health, and it caused a huge scandal. And in 1985, Margaret Thatcher was in so much problem with this that she had to order a study. Now, the veterans have always told me, since I started reporting this in 2002, that there was an issue with this study, which was that it never really looked at the things they had a problem with. It didn't look at miscarriages and birth defects and rare conditions. It only looked at mortality and cancer. And so earlier this year, when a fourth update, which the Mirror actually helped win, was published, and it showed there was huge, actually a very big difference in cancer rates in the veterans and in mortality, it was pushed all online, along with the first time this report from 1988. And so we said to the researchers, where's this from? What? How come there's two? And they said, oh yes, they're the main report and there's these companion reports, and they haven't been online before. I mean, all right. So who had this again? Sorry? And they said, oh yeah, we had some paper copies in the office, but no one ever asked us for them. So we went to the test veterans who were active in 1988 and said, do you remember getting that first study? And they said, oh yeah, we had the 7 pages in the BMJ. And I said, well, we've got 140 here with like loads of tables and data, and they show this rate of death and this and this. And I went, we never saw this. And the lawyers and the war pension advocates, I checked with them, they hadn't seen it. So it was available, but no one was ever signposted towards it. It was extra information on our methodology. It was really misleading not to say that was where the data was. So we uncovered that earlier this year, and we've explained some of that to the Prime Minister when we saw him last week.
And what next?
Well, the Prime Minister kind of, how can I put it? He sort of went, a lot. But he said, look, there's a couple of things we said to him. So we also have evidence that there were blood tests and urine samples taken from the men at Christmas Island, which is the kind of thing you do to test exposure to radiation. But when those men have later accessed their health records from their service history, they're not in there. They have not been included, or they're only partially included. So we showed the Prime Minister evidence of this, and we said, Prime Minister, if health records are being withheld or falsified, it's a criminal offence. And he agreed with us that it was, and that he wants those archives now opened up to find out what's really gone on. And he said to me at one point, so where are they? Where do you think they are? And I said, I don't know, I'm not the Prime Minister. You tell me where they are.
And the other aspect of this, which is especially relevant tonight, is that this is a story that Paul Foote wrote about.
Yes, so back in the 80s, and Paul was an investigative columnist for the Mirror for, I think, 14 years, and also later at Private Eye, and he covered the tests, as many, many reporters did at the time. And I was speaking to one guy, Ken McGinley, earlier on yesterday, who was the founder of the British Nuclear Test Veterans Association. He remembers Paul from 1986, and how he rang him up one day and said, Paul, I've got a story for you. And Paul's like, what is it? And said, I can't tell you. I've been given a decision from the House of Lords that we are now going to be, they've agreed an appeal in our favour. This is before the Supreme Court, and the House of Lords were deciding stuff. And they're going to agree to something in our favour that we can now proceed to maybe sue the government. And Paul was delighted, and he was supposed to not say anything until a certain time, because it was all embargo. And Ken opened the paper next day, and there it was. It broke the embargo. Naughty boy.
My name is Samantha Asimadu. I'm here for an article I wrote for Open Democracy.
And what was that article?
Well, it was a series of two. It was about indefinite prison sentences for public protection, which is a sentence that was banned in 2012 because of human rights abuses. They felt that what happens with it, I guess, is that around 2005, when Lord Blunkett was Home Secretary, he brought this sentence in. Nobody really knew much about it. The judges didn't really know much about it. The people, the prison staff, the psychologists that the prisoners eventually had to see didn't know much about it. So what happens is you found a sort of generation of working class white, black and brown men and women who, for minor crimes, have been in prison for up to 17 years now.
So I'm just going to stop you there because that's so extraordinary that I think it merits a bit more sort of digging down. So these were sentences handed out nominally of just a couple of years, but actually they were labelled as being indefinite. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. It's indefinite. Some people call them indeterminate. So you had people... one of the people I profiled was a man called Leroy who stole a mobile phone without violence. He's now been in there 17 years. He's still there. That's the whole thing. It's still a live issue. And there's campaigners that I talk to still now and their families because of how horrific it is. He's trying to get, they're all trying to get out. So you had other people, a lot of people stole mobile phones around 2005 and are still in prison. It's actually quite ridiculous. And I also profiled a woman called Charlotte Noakes. You know what? I don't know what crime she did, and I don't actually care what crime they did. They're not in there now for the crimes they committed. They are in there because they have been tortured by this indefinite, not knowing when you're getting out. So it's a matter of, there's a lot of self-harm. There's a lot of, they're the highest prison cohort for suicides. She died in 2016. Having said to her family before, she thought this was a death sentence, and that came up in the inquest, but they still said, that the prison had no fault in her death. But the reason I got shortlisted for this specific prize is for the second article I did, which my editor... So the first article did quite well. It went a bit viral. George Monbiot tweeted it and so on. He said, Guantanamo Bay, crime's going on. Yeah, and so it got a lot of attention. So my editor said, you can do a follow-up, maybe. And so he asked me to do, just an 800-word sort of collecting political reactions to what had happened, this sentence, etc. So I did do that. I got Greens, Lords, Lib Dems, Lord Blunkett himself, the guy who actually campaigns against the sentence now, even though he brought it in himself. But at the same time, I'm talking to the families, I'm also talking to the Ministry of Justice, and I found that this pattern started to emerge, where I was getting documents for the families where they were on their parole files. It was accusing them or saying they had done crimes that they had not committed. In some cases, the matter they weren't, they were in prison, so they couldn't have done what they are saying on these files. So I'm going back and forth with the Ministry of Justice, and then I'm getting more documents. And then at one point, I guess I'm talking to a campaigner, and she, she's getting excited about what I'm doing, and she tweeted it. And one of the people who was waiting to get documents from the prison to come, to come to me so you can report it, they stopped him being able to send post out because they knew what was going on. They knew it was coming. There was a few people. There was one guy, Martin Myers, who's a traveller who who, because of the fake crimes that they put on his file, has been beaten up multiple times because they said he was a sex offender. It's horrific and it's ongoing. And actually, he had a lawyer and got some compensation, £20,000, a while ago about it, but they still didn't clean his file. So every time he's moved to a different prison, because they're all moved all the time, all these 17 years, they keep being moved to prisons, so they have no connection with their family. You know, their family are chasing after them, trying to find them. He keeps getting beaten up, and you know, he just wants to get out because his mother, he thinks, is going to die soon. So,
is there a prospect of these sentences being brought to an end?
Well, Dominic Raab has come out post my articles, and then ITV did a little two part on it, and he says no, they'll never get out. But I don't know, I think with enough pressure, because, you know, if the person who originated the law is actually campaigning against it publicly, something has to change. And, you know, these people, some people get deported if you're not from it. It's quite sick and twisted in some ways. But I hope they will get out. I'm still, you know, so sometimes you do get out on parole, but then you're on license for life. So any little problem that turns up, you will be put in. If you're in a group of five people, you all get in trouble, you know, put in the cells. They will get out, but you will get put back into prison. You know, it's quite sad, actually.
My name is Solomon Hughes, and I'm a journalist who works largely, mostly on Private Eye, and I'm here to represent stories I wrote for Private Eye, which were published by that fantastic organ.
Okay, Solomon, can you tell us about the story that brought you from your desk at Private Eye here to the Private Eye Pulford Awards tonight?
Yeah, it was... It's during the pandemic, the government was spending a lot of money on a variety of anti-pandemic measures, and one of them was the testing centres, you know, which they didn't initially. They didn't want the NHS to run them. They didn't want local authorities to run them. They gave them to private companies because that's what they like to do. They like to spend all that COVID prevention money almost as a kind of boost to the private sector. And of course then the private sector did the things they do in a variety of ways. They did it in crappy ways, and one of the crappy ways they did it was testing centres. You know, they just recruited lots of staff on minimum wage, got them to stand around the high vis, guide you through, they'd swab your throats and all the rest of it in these kind of temporary enclosures. And one of the companies they gave a lot of the testing centres to was G4S. Many, many private contractors got a slice of that testing, sweet, sweet testing centre action, but G4S got a lot. Now, G4S, as soon as they got it, a lot of their recruitment, they farmed out to another privatisation contractor, a temp agency called HRGO. And then the staff turned up and they were inducted by G4S, given G4S high-vis jackets, but they looked at their payslips and said, that's not right, we better get in touch with Private Eye. In fact, they did get in touch with some other newspapers, which will not be mentioned, who didn't quite get the story together.
So what was wrong with their payslips that meant they were inspired to get in touch with the Eye?
Well, they looked at them and they thought, well, I thought I was working for G4S, but this has the name of an obscure company, in one case, with a ludicrous name, names like Androsa Snake. And the directors appear to be, I mean, this is quite a bright whistleblower that worked on this, the directors appear to be young women based in the Philippines, and I don't think they should be in charge of me. I don't think they are in charge of me. Something's funny is going on. And they worked a lot, to be honest, the whistleblowers worked a lot on this, about what they figured out was going on, and they got in touch with us.
Okay, and you then followed the story up. I mean, I know where the story is going, but I want to know what Androsa Snake was as a company. Why were these mysterious Philippine company directors getting involved in British COVID testing centres?
Yeah, why indeed, it's a mystery that we had to travel around the world to discover. So what was happening was every company gets a certain proportion of money that they keep for collecting national insurance. They've got to collect national insurance for the exchequer. You know, they collect it on your payslip, and to give them a little help in collecting it, they get an allowance. But if you then set up thousands and thousands of crazy little companies, each one employs just a small number of people, then all that allowance cancels out any national insurance they want. And so it's called the mini umbrella company fraud. These were mini umbrella companies who were nominally employing these people on the test sites, who were then really being employed via two more contractors. But it meant that somebody wasn't paying the national insurance. So all our taxpayers' money that we were putting in to try and stop COVID, and these people were working hard to stop COVID on the sites, they could see that some of that tax money was leaking away in a big, stupid, obvious fraud. Or maybe it's not so obvious, but something wrong was going on, and that's what we figured out.
So were G4S aware of this, as far as you can tell, that these mini umbrella companies were being used?
I think what was happening was this. We approached G4S, and at first they were very resistant and said, well, it's nothing to do with us. You need to speak to our subcontractor, HR Go. And then when we spoke to HR Go, they ignored us for a long time and then gave us a great big long legal letter that, you know, I couldn't really make head nor tail of, but, you know. So I think what G4S done is they put it at arm's length so they didn't have to know. And I think it was one of the companies, I think it was G4S, but it may have been HR Go, used the phrase, our long lines of labour subcontracting. And I just thought, well, don't have them. If you want someone to do a job, hire them to do a job. And having these long lines of labour subcontracting, it's a way of keeping things at arm's length so you don't know what's going on, not taking responsibility. And essentially what the mini umbrella company fraud people do is they sell a service, so they approach employers and say, we'll sort out payroll and it'll mean you will pay less. And sometimes they do it for free, sometimes they pay a bounty per employee, a small number, or some other kind of thing, but they save you money. Of course, they do save you money, but they save you money by cheating the taxpayer. HMRC recognise this is, and are really cross about this, but don't do enough about it because they don't have the people on the ground and they don't empower workers to take it up. And also it puts the workers at some other vulnerabilities as well. It means that if they had to go into dispute with their employer or take them to court or something like that, it'd be confusing because they'd say, oh, you know, G4S, you've done a bad thing and I've hurt my leg, or you stole my money, and you'd end up having to chase somebody in the Philippines who probably doesn't really know what they're doing.
Okay, so what was the upshot? What happened to all these mysterious mini-umbrella companies?
Well, in the end, after resisting us for longer than they should have done, they were lent on by the department, who lent on G4S, who lent on their subcontractors, and they were all sacked. In fact, what happened was G4S let their main subcontractor, a big and, you know, inverted commas, respectable company, HR Go, go. They let them go because, you know, I guess they had embarrassed them or let them down. So it was stopped. You know, we won, which is the good side. It's not all good news, but that's the good news.
I'm Hannah Aluthman from the Sunday Times.
I'm David Collins from the Sunday Times. The story that's brought us here tonight is the murder of Agnes Wanjiru. She is a young Kenyan woman who was killed in 2012. And the prime suspect for her murder has always been a British soldier or soldiers. The British Army have been connected with a murder since 2012. Yet, because of a completely ineffectual investigation by the Kenyan police, nobody has ever been brought to justice. It took 8 years. For her to even have an inquest, and the findings of the inquest in Kenya by a Kenyan judge was that on the balance of probabilities she was murdered by British soldiers. And what me and Hannah did was set out to investigate that.
How soon after the murder did you start investigating the story after Agnes's murder?
Oh, it was a decade, roughly. Yeah, about 9 years after the murder.
That must present a lot of challenges in terms of the amount of time that's elapsed between the death and your picking up the story.
I mean, yes and no, because the thing that sort of shocked us was what turned out was this had been an open secret within that regiment in the British Army for quite a long time. So once we started speaking to people, what transpired was that, you know, they were willing to give up that information, but nobody had ever really asked them before, which included the British Army and the Royal Military Police and also the Kenyan police. we had some names of some people who were there on the night, and then I suppose it was just very old-fashioned journalism. So approaching those people, working out who they were, because we only had partial names for some of them, only initials in some cases, and just saying, you know, what can you tell me? But also saying to them, who else might be able to tell me and give me that information? And then building up those relationships with them over some weeks, and, you know, encouraging them to trust us, and that they could be confident in sharing what they knew.
You mentioned that there was an inquest which took nearly 10 years to be completed, and that it concluded on the balance of probability that Agnes was murdered. What happens after that?
So after that, determination, it triggered a fresh investigation by the Kenyan authorities. So the Kenyan equivalent of the FBI, who are called the Directorate of Criminal Investigation, began a fresh inquiry, which started last year. And they were basically made to do that by the Kenyan judge. So that's why we've seen a new investigation. But the way we kind of built up this story was essentially we had a leak of documents from the original Kenyan police inquiry, which implicated a number of soldiers, or at least said these were the soldiers who were present in the Lions Court Hotel, which was a hotel that was used by the soldiers to basically drink and party. And these were the soldiers who were there that night. They are important witnesses, and they should be questioned by the police. And yet what we found was that a decade on, not a single one of those soldiers had ever been spoken to. So as Hannah said, you know, Hannah did an incredible job of groundwork in terms of, I was in Kenya, so I did that end, while Hannah worked on the names of the soldiers that we had. Basically, this was an open secret within the Duke of Lancaster Regiment. You know, we went to a number of different soldiers who told us the exact same name for the same person who people knew openly was responsible for the murder. And then I guess the jewel in the crown of the investigation was getting to a British soldier called Soldier Y, who not only was there that night, but was shown Agnes's dead body in the septic tank by the alleged killer.
Do you think it's remotely likely that the alleged killer will be brought to justice, tried, charged, arrested?
I mean, that's what we hoped when we published this, and I think, you know, I'd go as far as to say that this is what we expected. Not that he would be convicted, because you can't, you know, predict the outcome of a trial, but that, you know, he would be perhaps charged or at least questioned by the police. We thought that was, you know, the likely outcome, but that hasn't happened so far as we're aware.
What I think me and Hannah have both seen is the utterly broken system that we have in this country for investigating soldiers who have committed serious offences. You know, we have seen repeatedly the British government telling us, despite the fact that we know we effectively solved a murder within 2 months, a murder that the Kenyan and British authorities haven't managed to solve in 12 years. So that says to me the system doesn't work. But what the British government say is that they're powerless to investigate a British soldier who's committed a crime in Kenya, because the Kenyan authorities have to take responsibility for that murder. But the Kenyan authorities have shown themselves to be completely incompetent, so which means that essentially a British soldier's got away with murder currently.
You know, we're going to continue to report on this and to really ask the MOD why, you know, we've given them a name, we've given them the name of a witness. And, you know, we are going to push for answers on this, on why they haven't yet questioned this person in relation to Agnes's murder. And, you know, we're in touch with Agnes's family. David spent a lot of time in Kenya with Agnes's family, and, you know, all they've ever wanted really is for someone to be brought to justice for her murder. She had a young daughter, Stacey, who is now 10.
That's right, yeah.
So, you know, we'd like to keep on with it, and just, you know, we would like to see a resolution or an outcome one way or another.
So, Gabriel Pogrand, you work for the Sunday Times. Yeah. Can you tell us about the story?
We, over the last year, have dedicated a lot of time and column space to the life and times of Prince Charles, and in particular, the way in which people have paid for access to the future king, as well as honours bestowed in the royal family's name, hidden from public view. And actually, I mean, it started off all because of our scrutiny of the Tory party chairman, Ben Elliott, who we revealed had helped take one of his clients up to Charles's beloved country estate in rural Scotland.
And when we say his client, so Ben Elliott is the man who ran Quintessentially, I believe, is that right? And still runs Quintessentially, a kind of luxury concierge service providing elite services for very wealthy people.
It can fix you whatever you want, be that a pink jumbo jet to take you around the world for your 18th birthday, or be serenaded by Elton John by the Pyramids of Giza. I don't think that one actually happened, but they can do that sort of thing. And off the back of this, we learned that Elliot had taken a client of his Quintessentially business to Dumfries House, which is this 18th century country home that Charles spends as much of his time as possible residing at. And off the back of this, we ended up kind of finding ourselves ensconced in this oleaginous universe of fixers whose job it is to sort of marry money and royalty. And the thing that we'd exposed that has since led to various investigations, including but not limited to by Scotland Yard, is that there was a Saudi businessman, a Jeddah-based banker called Mahfouz bin Mahfouz, who paid seven figures and in exchange got an honour. He got an actual CBE, and he had a secret ceremony with His Royal Highness in Buckingham Palace, not published naturally on the court circular.
Where it should be.
Exactly. I mean, I think they aren't always totally fastidious in their attention to detail when it comes to the court circular. I think it tends to reflect what they want you to think they're up to rather than what they're up to. But we found out, for instance, that Charles, while on an official visit to Saudi Arabia, had in fact taken a detour to the British Embassy, where he posed for pictures and generally glad-handed with the extended Mahfouz clan. So he's there representing us, but actually, you know, he was involved in the grubby business of soliciting donations. And off the back of our coverage, there was lots of scrutiny. There was a referral to the police, and the Metropolitan Police are still investigating.
How much can you say you know about how much Prince Charles knew about the arrangement? Because one of the aspects of your story is there's this whole circle of fixers and greasers and people who arrange things, and obviously, you know, there have been resignations, I believe, from Prince Charles's circle. Michael Fawcett, is that right? Can you tell us a bit more about him? And also tell us how much you think you know Prince Charles knew about the whole affair.
That's an amazing question. I mean, it's a $64,000 question, or more accurately, the £1.5 million question. And I've got to say, I mean, I think we have to put our faith in our readers to make a judgment. I mean, in the end, Charles, he's met these fixers repeatedly. He's went for a country walk with one of them during lockdown. He paid a detour on a trip to the Gulf to meet one of these donors. These fixers literally met with Charles's aides inside Clarence House to plot out how they would secure an honour for Mr. Mahfouz. And then Charles awarded it to him. He literally put it onto his lapel. So, I mean, it can't be that Charles is both, according to his courtiers, most amazingly intellectually curious character in the world, and yet suddenly suspended all of his critical faculties when it came to these many meetings with people who were, you know, extracting money for his various projects. But as for Fawcett, so you're right, there have been a few investigations, or a few resignations rather. The chief executive of the Prince's Foundation has resigned. That's Michael Fawcett, Charles's long-standing confidant. I'm not sure it's the last we'll see of him. He does have a sort of cat-like ability to both, to land on his feet. And I think he's had more lives than one in royal terms. He resigned twice in the 90s and noughties and came back. For the time being, though, he's gone.
He's the Peter Mandelson of the royal circle, basically.
Yeah, I'm not sure who that is most unflattering to. I'm not going to speculate. I'm going to rein myself in as an impartial reporter. But Fawcett has been this sort of rock to Charles for decades. He supported him through the Diana divorce. He started as a footman to Queen Elizabeth, and Charles spotted him. And in fact, Michael Fawcett had gone home one day as a teenage footman to his family home in Kent and said to his father, I'm going to go work for Charles because he said that he likes me. And it was the beginning of this amazing decades-long partnership. And Charles basically has always refused to cut ties with this man, who has constantly been a source of negative headlines and sort of, perpetrating all sorts of suspect practices within his household. And as his reign draws ever closer, it is, I think it does pose some pretty serious questions of Charles's judgment that he won't get shot at this man.
One last question. This must have been a hell of a story to get through the lawyers.
You know what? It was, it's funny that. I mean, obviously the British media law is increasingly restrictive for our noble profession, but in this instance we were endowed with such amazing documentary evidence. We saw the actual emails in which they were saying, step one, donate money, step two, receive honour. I mean, we had the emails that they were sending to the FCO saying, how do we get this Saudi foreign national honour? So it was so exquisitely crystal clear that fortunately we did not fall foul of many of the strictures that apply to the media at the moment.
So, Eleanor Rose of Liberty Investigates, can you tell us a little bit about the story that's brought you here this evening?
We submitted three stories together, which all cover the way that the UK treats asylum seekers in the past year. And the kind of centrepiece of that series of stories is about Esparto 11, which was a deportation flight that took off in August 2020.
So what was interesting or unusual about Sparta 11?
Yeah, one of the reasons we covered it is because we felt like nobody had ever kind of visualized inside a deportation flight before. And I obtained some documents about the use of force by detention custody officers on the deportees during that flight. And what we discovered as we looked further and further into that flight was that it was the first in a series, an unprecedented series of flights called Esparto flights, about 20 charter flights, which took off specifically to take asylum seekers from conflict-stricken countries to states in Europe that were not their countries of origin, but these kind of third country removals. And this kind of very concentrated program of charter flights was done just before Brexit because it relied on the EU law, the Dublin Convention. So it was Priti Patel and the Home Office ejecting as many asylum seekers as possible using the convention before Brexit.
Forgive me for asking a stupid question. Why was the British government able to deport nationals from other countries to European countries they weren't from?
Because the Dublin Convention allows EU states to transfer asylum seekers purely for administrative purposes between themselves. So say an asylum seeker had passed through France and they ended up in the UK, the UK could apply to have their claim considered in France rather than in the UK, which presumably would have the effect of reducing asylum caseload in the UK.
Were you able to track what had happened to some of the people on that particular flight after it landed?
Yeah, so we traced one guy, Omar, who was living on the streets of in France, destitute, sleeping on a pallet in the streets, who had experienced use of force during that flight. And we discovered that he'd arguably been removed unlawfully. And after we published the story, his case was taken up by a lawyer, and a High Court judge ordered that he be returned to the UK by Priti Patel, which then took place. So Omar has been returned to the UK because his removal was arguably unlawful, which is what our story showed.
That's a remarkable result to have achieved, particularly on his behalf. I was just wondering, can you tell me a little about what this story says about the overall brokenness of the British immigration and emigration system?
Well, yeah, I mean, so what we noticed was a number of the deportees on the flight hadn't had access to legal representation, and the screening interviews that are run by the Home Office to identify victims of trafficking, potential victims of trafficking and torture, have been shortened, and they missed a number of people who were actually potentially victims of torture and trafficking and deported them. And I guess that with the Rwanda flight taking off this evening, one of the things we said in that story was we could see that if Priti Patel proceeded with the plans she was going forwards with to reform UK's immigration system, asylum system, there would be many more third country removal flights like Esparto 11.
So that's it. That's all the nominees for the Paul Foot Awards 2022. Let's now go over to the room where the editor of Private Eye, Ian Hislop, is about to announce the winner.
Thank you very, very much for coming. This is incredibly exciting. There's a huge audience. There must be 200 people here. And Piers Morgan would kill for that. I have a few apologies here. They're all from the Prime Minister. He doesn't mean any of them. This is probably the only party he's not coming to. One apology from Prince Andrew. He's got COVID. Long COVID. About 20 years, I think. We were going to do a Gnome Mart this week for a special royal COVID test kit, which has already got the red line marked in. We were also going to do a booometer so that Nadine Dorris could put it up to the telly and hear nothing but cheers. Anyway, genuine cheers tonight, because we are here to celebrate journalism and celebrate getting through the pandemic, which I think journalism has done pretty spectacularly in the last 2 years. Against the odds, there was a real public appetite for news, for information, and for getting to the truth of what was going on, which was remarkable and also quite cheering. We were repeatedly told every time any journalist got a story, the public aren't interested. They're not interested. The PPE scandals, Partygate, Rishi Sunak's wife, care home disasters. No, the public aren't interested. But they were. And they read what journalists had to say about it. And not only those COVID-related stories, but other stories below the line. Last year, I made a speech about how annoying it was to be told by politicians to move along. Well, they haven't had any ideas since last year. That's it. Everyone has to move along. The only thing they've added this year is the idea of we move on, we move along, and also we draw a line under it. Whatever's happened, whether it happened yesterday or 5 seconds ago, we draw a line under it. And I think the whole point of journalism is not to draw a line under it, unless it's in, you know, felt tip and say, let's do this again. What we can do is go back and do it again. So, the winner of... It's my Anton Deck moment. The Paul Foot Award 2022 goes to the Sunday Times, Hannah Al-Othman and David Collins.
It's a good round of applause. Thank you, everyone. It's a huge honour. The Paul Foot Award is the one that, you know, a lot of reporters want to win this award, and hugely grateful. The Sunday Times, I've always felt, is a great place to work, especially if you're an investigative reporter. And they take, you know, investigations very seriously, from the editor right through to the legal team, through to the news desk. So it's always good to kind of have that structure in place and that support. With that in mind, just to thank a few people. Emma Tucker, the editor, who believed in the story from the very beginning. Ben Taylor, the deputy editor. Underneath, Catherine Faulkner, who really kind of quarterbacked us for the very beginning of this story. And obviously Hannah, whose reporting was absolutely incredible on this.
I think we should also thank, I mean, none of them are here and none of them are probably going to hear this, but also our legal team who helped us get it over the line, and Breed especially, and
Breed.
And all our sources, all the, you know, dozens of people who spoke to us and Agnes's family, who have cooperated with us from the start. When we first set out to do this, we never expected to actually solve it, and it became evident quite quickly that the answer had been there in plain sight for a decade and nobody had ever bothered to ask the question. So yeah, what we're aiming to do, and we're still aiming to do, is get the people that need to ask the same questions that we did, and hopefully bring someone to justice for it. So yeah, we hope this isn't the end. But thank you to everyone that's read it and engaged with it and shared it and helped us get it this far. And yeah, everyone at the Sunday Times.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's it from the Pulford Awards. Congratulations to the richly deserving winners, David Collins and Hannah Al Othman from the Sunday Times, and to all the rest of the nominees on the shortlist. They really have proved that the spirit of investigative journalism is absolutely thriving. It is alive and well. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We'll be back again next month with another one. Until then, if you can't get your fix quickly enough for the next monthly episode of this show, why not pick up a copy of Private Eye on newsstands or subscribe online? Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.